This is an Enterprise Times podcast. I'm here with Carol Fitzgerald Tyler, Global Senior Practice Director, Organizational Change Management in Infor. Hello.
Hello, how are you?
I'm good, thank you, and you?
Excellent, so happy to be here, thank you.
Digital transformation kind of sounds like a long-winded, very expensive process, and it's also a big thing that people seem difficult to swallow. Can you give your opinion of it, please?
Great way to start in the fact that digital transformation is this phrase that is getting attached to so many different initiatives and organizations. The way I like to approach this and work with my customers on this is to break it up into small pieces. What does digital transformation mean to that specific organization? It might mean one thing to an aerospace and defense customer. It could mean something completely different to a healthcare customer. So the first thing I like to do is try to define the boundaries of that particular organization's initiatives. And then from there, we can start working into, is this the big, hairy, audacious goal in 5 years? Or are these some of the things that we can take bit by bit? Like, can we improve the customer experience immediately with a mobile app? Or could we streamline finance so that they're closing their books much more quickly, rather than looking at, we're going to transform an entire enterprise in 18 months, which rarely happens. Does that make sense?
You're talking about horizontal changes in a sense.
Or vertical changes as well.
You also have the side of digital transformation, which is outside of the existing organizational processes. And it's that bit that people think that's where the gold dust is, although it also lies within the organization. So how do they manage to combine both of those? Or do you take that macro thinking as well at the same time?
It's a really good question. My thought is always, when I meet with somebody or when I talk with an organization, I always ask them, what is your end goal? What strategy can we put into place that puts the end in mind? Because if we don't know where the end is, we can't start from the beginning. So when I look at an organization, and I'll give you a great example, working with a big healthcare organization in the United States right now, they want to transform their expense management system, their finance system, their human resources system, the payroll system, and the supply chain system. That's the end goal overall, but that's going to take segments and chunks. That's a good example of a broad and siloed organization. Each one of the healthcare facilities has its own personality. Each one of the corporate entities and service centers has its own personality. So we're trying to create a methodology that can pervade all of those different silos, verticals, horizontals, and take the organization from where it is today to 24 months from now, a whole different viewpoint with things like employee portals and patient portals and just expanding the user experience for the people that are participating in that healthcare system.
Who are the right kind of people to do that work? Do you need to go and hire lots of graduates as smart millennials, or do you need to turn to just your IT people because they're the ones who understand technology, aren't they?
I worked with a pretty big aerospace and defense company in Israel recently. We came up with the term that this type of process takes everybody from the graduates to the grandmas, and we have to appeal in different ways to that whole group of people. I think the conversation around millennials is really interesting. I am a mentor to some millennials that are literally rocket scientists. They have a very interesting viewpoint that they bring to things and projects. However, the more mature people, shall we say, like me, for example, they have the business and the people emotional knowledge that have to be combined. So the other example I'll give you is I have a friend who is a CIO of a major publishing company. They look at this as not an IT initiative, even though IT needs to participate. They look at this more as a people initiative that is fueled by IT. So I think if I were to design an ideal team, I would pick from all of those places. I would pick from millennials who are very savvy to today's technologies because they give us the perspective on mobility. They give us the perspective on how things can go faster. And then I would also choose a range of IT and business people to come around and say, now, here's how it used to work. Here's how I can help vision the future. I would pick a combined team, and as we like to say, from the graduates to the grandmas, because that's who has to change in the organization.
I love the diversity phrase there. Is there a question in terms of bringing in a wider set of diversity nowadays, though, as well? Do you need to try and make sure, especially as companies are internationalizing faster now, and there are regional differences between different countries and cultures in different countries and business cultures, do you need to try and bring in that into your digital transformation as well?
Absolutely. We live in a very small world now. Commerce and networking goes global. And there are definitely some, I would say, cultural differences that need to be addressed when you think about digital transformation and organizational change management. Even within, just I'll say, United States-centric, there's a very different mindset on the West Coast than there is on the East Coast. So just that as a microcosm example tells us that we have to take into consideration a center of excellence that might be located in India or China. Brazil is a hot new country where IT is coming out of. Poland, what used to be the Eastern European countries, have a huge technology presence that, to me, add a wonderful flavor and complexity to these projects. It would be foolish to not take advantage of that cultural and tribal knowledge that lives within organizations that are bigger than in one spot. If we take even the UK-centric, you're still not dealing with the UK. You're dealing with cultural differences between Wales and Scotland and Ireland and how people think and how they want to change versus how they've changed in the past. So taking a global view is absolutely critical to this type of project.
Changing topic a bit, how has organizational change management changed and evolved over the last 5 years?
Great question. When I very, very first started learning about organizational change management, that was 2004. And then if we fast forward to the last 5 years, a lot of practitioners have been able to take advantage of some certifications. Change management has actually become a study, a form of study, particularly surrounding the areas of organizational leadership and communication. What I've seen in the past 5 years specifically is a much bigger focus on the communications. 95% of projects that don't have good communication planning and good communication strategies are oftentimes in trouble in one way or the other. And a lot of projects will literally fail. So having somebody who is an excellent communicator and who can help identify communication issues within an organization, that's where I've seen a lot of development, is people being much more in tune with how communications and why communications are so important. Because if you don't particularly have an opportunity to redo impressions from a change management perspective, OCM developing, the other part that has gotten a lot bigger in 5 years is the partnership that we're seeing with digital transformation. In my opinion, you can't do one without the other, and OCM has had to reach and stretch to understand the digitization of the world and help encompass that from a change perspective.
What are you seeing as the common obstacles to organizational change management? Have they changed much over the last few years?
Interesting question, because people still resist change no matter what. I think that's going to be a constant in the world, but I think some of the newer obstacles, one obstacle that people have in their minds as a difficulty is the whole migration to the cloud. They can't see the cloud, they can't touch the cloud, they can't feel and smell the cloud. That has become this obstacle of what's really happening. And going back to our original conversation, the millennials are very cloud comfortable. The older you get, people are wondering, where is my data and why is it in this cloud and where is this cloud? So I think the obstacles are to really, again, communicate and have people understand and feel comfortable with the shifts to a new way of doing business in the cloud. And cloud is great, but getting people to think about what that really means is a challenge.
And what are the key risks that companies need to think about when they're going through that organizational change and digital change now?
We just said the digital change, if there is a massive risk if companies don't take into consideration the people aspects of the entire transformation. We can have the best IT strategies, we can have the best cloud strategies, we can have the very best plans in place from project management and program direction, But if we don't sit back and find, for example, pockets of resistance, people in the organization that are absolutely anti whatever the digital transformation is, their voices can be much louder than the voices of the positive influences. Another example I would give you is a relatively famous candy company that I've spoken with their CIO. They had a failed implementation because they didn't take into account all the people that needed to be involved. They only thought, well, this is a supply chain issue, and were very compartmentalized, and then found out that that rippled into the organization and it caused some very major problems. So I would say another risk is to be very myopic rather than global thinking, and being able to look at the entire organization and say, how do I need to shift this part, this country, that service center? If you don't take a good look at all the people that are going to be impacted and how, maybe doing some risk analysis, talking to the stakeholders, making sure that everybody's in alignment as best as possible, and that will change over the course of the organizational timeline, but that risk of not communicating and not involving a good, solid people transition plan is one of the biggest ones that I see.
We're now living in an age of business networking. So what about external to the organization? Because they can be impacted.
Absolutely. And even better question, I'll give a healthcare example again. Suppliers are external to the organization, and yet if the supplies don't come in, patient cases can't be performed. You have to involve and understand your partnerships, your suppliers. Let's say you're going to build an airplane and you want to transition your company to a different way of doing that. Boeing, for example, has 75 different suppliers that bring in different pieces and parts. If you were not to involve that network and communicate with them, you couldn't have an effective transformation or change management process. Looking again to the bigger picture, when you sit down and start something like this, and we said we want to strategize to keep the end in mind, who are all the people in that ecosystem that have a piece or a part of that whole transition?
Coming back to communication, I always like to hear the best example of communication during a change program that you've seen.
Can it be my example? The best that I can offer was in one of my initial customers. We took the sixth largest healthcare system in the United States and brought them live on various things, and I was the change management and communications director. What we did is we sat down and we took a very untraditional view of the organizations that we were dealing with. We brought in managers and directors who believed that they weren't necessarily front line of the change. And we executed on manager and director meetings at each one of the different facilities. And the first couple were a little rough because we didn't know how to communicate with that audience. And then we started to get into this great cadence, and they started doing the talking for us rather than us. The compliment that I will always take with me from how we executed those plans was a CFO who told me 2 weeks after the go-live that he didn't even notice. It was a non-event, and it was because of the great communications planning that we put into place.
How do you get them talking at the events when, in theory, you are communicating the knowledge during the event?
I'd like to say I have a little bit of a way of doing that. It could have something to do with the fact that I kissed the Blarney Stone in 1983. But the more practical way is when you put people in a group, they do tend not to talk, especially if they don't want to be embarrassed, they don't want to open up and be vulnerable. What I try to do is I try to create an atmosphere that allows people to be vulnerable, to ask questions, so that they're not feeling like, oh, you know, if I ask this question, I'm going to be labeled as not correct for this project. I ask some very gentle probing questions right up front and say, what do you think about this? And I just gave a workshop to a group of leaders at a healthcare company last Friday. They, again, were very reticent to talk, and I basically said, look, this is a very safe place. Let's talk with one another so that we can learn from one another. And I think a lot of it has to do with the tone that gets set in a meeting like that. Coming back to my example, when we were meeting with the managers and directors, we had a room full of up to 200 people at different facilities, but I tried to create a humorous, light atmosphere that allows people to be and ask the questions that are relevant. Because if they don't ask, Then we get 1 week into the go-live and things have gone south and not been appropriately executed. If you just lecture to people, they're not going to respond to you. If you put in intentional breaks in a presentation where you can turn it into an exchange, that will foster itself and keep people talking.
I probably asked this question already once, but digital transformation, technology project, I think your opinion is no, it's a people project.
I think it's mostly people, but I also think that IT plays a huge role in this, because if you really think about it, IT is one of the biggest places where change is occurring. They might be moving from an on-premise situation where they're doing all the work to being able to do other parts of their job. Instead of being completely focused on supporting a colleague who needs a report all the time, they've transitioned into a different phase of what they're doing as well. IT is a huge part. Now, what's interesting is I've been studying digital transformation. Who's running this from an executive level? Is it a CFO? Is it a CIO? It's interesting to see the combinations that are happening, because it used to be purely CIOs. Now it's switching around to be CFOs in some cases, or a partnership arrangement between the CHRO, the CFO, and the CIO. IT is a huge component, but they're a component. There's the how do we move the people side and make sure that the business understands that digital transformation isn't just some fancy term for upgrading to the cloud.
I'm quite surprised you don't see CEOs being more the key sponsor for digital transformation, because it is generally a strategic change, unless you're talking about the horizontal changes.
More the horizontal, because one of the things I talk about is if a company doesn't have a digital strategy, it either soon will or it won't be a company any longer. To your point, and I think it's a good one, the CEO has to be setting the vision. I'm a big proponent of very visible executive leadership setting vision, and then that vision tends to translate down into that horizontal that you mentioned, where the vision's been set at the highest C level, the CEO position, and then it's taken up by the next level, a group of executives that can help reset the vision. It's similar in one of the examples I give a lot is when JFK, John F. Kennedy, said, we're going to go to the moon and come back to Earth safely within the decade. That's the CEO vision. And then that trickled down to NASA, and then that trickled down to a group of people that moved to a swamp to launch a major initiative. The first level has to be at the C, and then it'll trickle down.
Where I've seen change projects fail is often because that first level of management are not coordinated and they're not a team. Is that one of the risks that companies need to be aware of? And specifically, I suppose, the CEO needs to be aware of. It's even more important now that actually he doesn't have necessarily the best individuals. He has the best team within his organization.
I should have mentioned that when we were talking about risks. Any project that I've ever worked on that had active and visible executive leadership, C-level or right below, like a president type person, has been successful. Any project I've ever worked on where there hasn't been that vision and that leadership has not been successful. One was a catastrophic failure, truly catastrophic failure. And I literally never, ever spoke to that C-level person who was designated as the executive sponsor, because he could not find time for it. And the project failed badly. It was one of the worst experiences of my life. But anytime I've had somebody who's been that spokesperson, that figurehead in many ways, setting that vision has been great. And I think that if you don't have that, then you have to either find that or change the game somehow, because that is a risk.
You got any question for me?
My question for you is, I'll turn it back from a digital transformation perspective. What trends might you be seeing that you could share with me?
There are a lot of trends, and I think that's one of the problems at the moment. The problem I see in companies is that, A, companies don't know how to innovate internally. There is so much stuff that they can do, and the messaging around digital transformation is a bit like the messaging around cloud 10 years ago. It's everything. And actually, it needs to be segmented, as you've done, in terms of that horizontal and, to a certain extent, the product and the vertical piece. That's good. It is digital transformation, but there's probably a better word for it somewhere. Or it's a subset of digital transformation that needs to be better defined. And then there is also what I would call business transformation. which is that macro vision transformational change, in the same way Rolls-Royce changed. They changed from being a product company to being a service company. It's that servitization, which companies, yeah, they still make products, but actually now they offer maintenance service, and it's just a complete change. Is that a good example? Uber don't own any cars. Well, are they going to? Because they're going to have autonomous vehicles, potentially. So actually they're going to shift from having no cars to being a full fleet, potentially in 10, I think 5's a bit optimistic after the accidents recently, 10 years, 15 years. It will come, but they will then own the cars.
Really good points, and to one of your points, the whole idea of servitization and innovating from inside and creating new opportunities, new revenue streams, whole new ways of doing business. If you were to say to the average person, hey, we're going to digitally transform you and servitize you and innovate you, to your point, it is the buzzword right now. That's why I think it's really important to get to a more micro level and help people see what they can do and open up their imaginations to how can I upend this? I mean, Rolls-Royce is a great example. We made engines, we made cars. And now, maybe I put an engine on a Virgin Atlantic plane, I know that that engine could potentially talk to me and tell me, I need maintenance, you need to fix this fan blade, my intakes aren't working. And that's a whole different thought process than having a mechanic check that engine every 500 hours. So you're totally upending the way we as a collective globe think about doing business.
The costs of that IoT implementation are coming down, so it's not just going to be the expense of aero engines, it's going to come down to the fridges and other devices. And I think the other thing that's going to change in terms of trend is the green trend, in the sense that you will see more people will start making devices like fridges to last longer. They won't be throwaway devices, because actually they'll make the money on the rental and the service, not on building the product. So actually if they can build a product and last a long time, they'll make far more money through the subscription model.
And the subscription model, as my colleague was saying this morning, we are in the evolutionary stage right now, because the subscription model is a new way to think about doing business. Old goal of manufacturing was make a bunch of things and people will buy things and they'll keep replacing the things. Versus exactly what you just said, that I don't want to throw things away. The green trend is actually much more prevalent in Europe, if you ask me. It's coming to America. It's getting better. But I love that Copenhagen, for example, there's recycling bins in the hotels and there's ways to save energy. Even here in the UK, you have to put your key in the hotel thing to get the lights to work. That's not quite there yet, but that trend is going to sweep the globe. Environmental conscientiousness is super important, and businesses should be aware of that, innovate towards that, and take advantage of it.
Thank you very much, Carol.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate the opportunity. It's been a pleasure.